seem to know one another very well, considering one of you is a lord and the other a mere waiter. Alex blinked at her. He opened his mouth to say something but closed it, as onlookers who'd not dared intervene in the kidnapping approached now that it was safe. The women fussed over Mr. Glass while the men exchanged witness accounts. He ignored them all.
Are you all right?
He asked Daisy and me. Fine, thank you, I said.
Thank you for what you did. It was good of you to try to save me.
Try? Daisy echoed. She was still irritated with the waiter named Alex. Sylvia did more than try. If she hadn't kicked that man, he would have succeeded in bundling you into the motor. Alex gave a derisive snort. Mr. Glass shot him a glare, more severe than the last. Alex rubbed a hand across his mouth, somewhat chastised. The exchange set me on edge. Alex seemed to think we had something to hide. Perhaps he even thought we were linked to the kidnappers. Mr. Glass was harder to read, but it was possible he was silencing his friend so as not to give away their suspicions. My nerves were still on edge, my heart racing, and I had a sudden urge to get as far away from Mr. Glass as possible. Not only did he attract danger, but he either blamed me for distracting him with my questions about his mother, or he suspected me of being directly involved with the kidnappers. My saving him meant nothing. I had saved him, hadn't I? I was no longer sure. It had all happened so fast. Perhaps my kick had connected after Mr. Glass managed to free himself. No wonder he thought us silly fools for claiming his freedom was all because of me. It was likely I'd done nothing but give the kidnapper a bruise.
You ought to report the incident,
said one of the gentlemen who'd rushed up after the danger had passed. There are never any constables nearby when you need one, his wife said. You ought to be thanking my friend, Daisy cut in, her voice rising over the top of them. Mr. Glass hesitated, then gave me a little bow.
Thank you, Miss Ash.
Properly, not with a condescending tone.
That was proper,
Alex ground out. Daisy straightened to her full height, which was considerably less than his. Mr. Glass was tall, but Alex was a giant. I beg to differ, she said simply.
Neither of you have answered my questions.
Alex turned to me. The muscles on his face were tight, his body rigid. There was no evidence of the kind man who'd helped me pick up the fallen pastries. He wanted answers, and he looked as though he'd do anything to get them.
Who are you, and what are you doing here?
I suddenly felt very hot and a little faint. I glanced from him to Daisy to Mr. Glass. Then I turned on my heel and walked away.
Miss Ash,
Mr. Glass called out.
Gabe, no.
That was Alex speaking.
Your motor is here. Get in. The only place you're going now is home.
Gabe? Daisy was right. These two knew each other well. She was right about Mr. Glass's tone being condescending too, which only confirmed that I hadn't helped free him. At least he didn't try to stop us leaving, despite his suspicions that we were involved in the kidnapping. Daisy fell into step alongside me. That man is not at all what I hoped he'd be like. Oh? I blame his wealth, title, and good looks, not to mention all the fuss made over him being a war hero and saving that boy from drowning. I'm not denying that he is a hero, but the praise has gone to his head. That's the problem with men like Mr. Glass. They don't have to strive for what they want because people just give them everything. I bet he's never worked a day in his life, never had to struggle for anything, including recognition. So you no longer consider his many attributes to be virtues? I do not. We walked on, only to turn when my name was called out again. Mr. Glass hailed us from the front passenger seat of his motor car.
Miss Ash, please, may I have a word?
Interrogate, more like, Daisy muttered. Mr. Glass went to open the door, but Alex, sitting behind, clamped a hand on his shoulder.
No, Gabe, the kidnappers could still be in the vicinity.
We didn't wait to see what Mr. Glass did next. Daisy steered me down one lane, then another, and another, until I was quite lost. London was still new to me, and this wasn't a part I visited often. We were in the heart of the high-end shopping precinct, judging by the boutique shops on both sides of the street. We passed the entrance to a luxury hotel where a doorman nodded a greeting, and a porter collected parcels from a waiting carriage. This wasn't an area of the city where hawkers pushed rickety old carts filled with odds and ends, or shopkeepers stood out the front and shouted the daily special. The ladies were genteel, the gentlemen upright and proper. Some of the younger men wore officers' uniforms. Neither of us mentioned Mr. Glass again. Daisy had gone quiet, however, and a small furrow dented her brow. "What is it?" I asked. "I thought I'd have more presence of mind than to stand there and just scream." "Screaming is an excellent response to danger. It alerted those nearby. Who would have thought that of the two of us, you'd be the one to act?" It surprised me too, at first. But when I thought about it, it was understandable. Daisy had confidence in abundance, but it was of the verbal rather than physical kind. She was an artist at heart. From her accent and manner, I could tell she was well brought up, educated, and most likely came from a loving household where her greatest fear was whether her younger brother would eat her helping of breakfast. While I wouldn't say my life was hard, it wasn't as soft as hers had probably been. I'd also been taught to defend myself by my mother. From a young age, she'd shown me ways and means to get out of a man's grip if I were being attacked. Today was the first time I put those lessons into practice. My mother would have been proud of me, proud and terrified, although she would have found comfort in the knowledge that I was helping someone else and not the target myself. Not that I was entirely sure I had helped Mr. Glass. "So what will you do now?" Daisy asked. "Call on the Silversmiths Guild." "I'll come with you. What will you ask them?" "I have no idea." Silversmiths Hall, the headquarters of the Worshipful Company of Silversmiths, was not open at the weekend. We'd walked all the way from Piccadilly to the city centre for nothing. We should have waited for the bus. With a hand clamped to her navy felt hat to stop it falling off, Daisy tipped her head back and swore softly at the two rearing dragons carved in stone above the first floor balcony door. You would think a company wealthy enough to be housed in such a grand building as this would be able to afford a porter to answer questions at the weekend. I leaned against the high pedestal at the base of one of the enormous columns holding up the portico and sighed. A porter may not be able to answer our questions. We need to check their archives for families named Ash. The silver magic connection, if there was one, might not be to the Ashes. James may have suspected it was my mother's family or another branch of the family tree. I didn't know any of those names, including her maiden name. I was diving blindly into the research, and it could end up being an impossible task. That's why I'd wanted to start with Lady Rycroft. If James had written her name down in his notebook, I was certain that meant he suspected she could provide us with a shortcut to answers. Daisy hooked her arm through mine. "Come on, let's find a tea shop, then go home." "Do you mind if I skip the tea shop? It's been quite a day." "Very well, I want to start a new painting anyway. One of the oils at the exhibition inspired me. Did you notice it? The one with the steamship? Not usually my sort of thing, but there was something quite lovely about it. The way the artist captured the sunlight on the crests of the waves was pure genius, and the smoke spewing from the funnels. If I could paint half as well as him, I could die happy." "Don't be so macabre, Daisy." She squeezed my arm. "Don't fret, my sweet little friend. I'm not dying anytime soon. You're stuck with me now." I would have given her a smile in return, but I didn't want her to see the tears filling my eyes. She'd think me pathetic. But I couldn't help it. I'd somehow found myself a real friend without even trying. I'd not had a good friend in, well, perhaps ever. Moving every year or two as a child had made it difficult to maintain friendships. My mother and I had stayed put for the entire 4 years of war, but had once again moved to a new city after my brother died. We'd both been too busy working in her final months to make friends there. I thought myself beyond the age when new friends were easily made anyway, but Daisy had proved me wrong. Having arrived in London a few months before me, she was also looking for female companionship. It seemed we'd both found each other when we needed someone the most. My room in the lodging house may not have a bathroom, kitchen, or sitting room, but there was enough space for a small table, a chair and shelves on which to store some books, personal items, and cans of peaches for when I didn't feel like joining the other lodgers in the basement dining room at mealtimes. I'd made myself a cup of tea and brought it up to my room and had just sat down to enjoy it when Daisy burst in without knocking. "They're coming," she said, breathless.
"Who?"
"Mr. Glass and that friend of his, Alexander Bailey. We'll pretend you're not here. Hopefully that dragon of a matron can convince them you're out." "She won't lie for me." She glanced around the room. "You could hide." "Daisy, stop." She was going too fast and left me far behind at the station. "How do you know Mr. Glass and Mr. Bailey are coming here? And how did you learn the waiter's last name?" "They came to my flat and asked me where to find you."
"And you just told them?"
She chewed on her lower lip.
"I'm afraid I just gave in. They were all very official and somewhat authoritative. I blame Alex Bailey. Mr. Glass is nice, but his friend is quite rude. He demanded I tell them where you live."
I squeezed the bridge of my nose and tried to make sense of her words. "Official?"
"I cycled here as fast as I could, taking the shortcut, but I'm afraid they're not far behind me."
Mrs. Whitten, the matron, arrived.
"You have visitors, Miss Ash. 2 men.
Her disapproving scowl emphasized her thick features and double chins.
"They're in the main sitting room."
Daisy clasped my hand between both of hers, attempting to hold me back. Her wide eyes implored me not to meet with them.
"Come along, Miss Ash. I haven't got all day."
I didn't see that I had any choice. Besides, it would give me an opportunity to tell them we were not in any way involved in the kidnapping. "We ought to set them straight, Daisy. They're under the false impression that we are somehow to blame for that incident."
"Miss Ash."
Daisy sighed.
"Lead on."
We followed Mrs. Whitten along the corridor, past the sign on the wall reminding us to keep innocence, albeit in vain. Although male guests were not allowed up to the rooms, I knew some of the girls had found inventive ways of sneaking their suitors in. Mrs. Whitten pushed open the door to the main sitting room. I hesitated on the threshold. Mr. Glass stood near the fireplace with Mr. Bailey. They both loomed rather large and sported the same grim expressions as they stared into the clean grate. They looked up upon our entrance.
"Miss Ash, thank you for joining us."
Mr. Glass extended his hand to me.
"Allow me to introduce my friend, Alex Bailey, properly."
He cleared his throat.
"Hopefully, we can wipe the slate clean and begin again."
Mr. Bailey's sheepish nod in greeting proved he was suitably chastised. That sheepishness was replaced with coolness as he regarded Daisy. She folded her arms and regarded him with an equally frosty look. Being late Saturday afternoon, the lodgers who worked in offices or as teachers were not at work. A small group were enjoying cups of tea and the view that had just walked in on 2 sets of long legs. Some openly ogled Mr. Glass and Mr. Bailey, while others attempted subtlety by peering over the rims of their teacups. The main sitting room was the larger of the two in the building. Just because it was larger didn't mean it was more elegant. It was a utilitarian space designed to fit the maximum number of tables, chairs, and sofas. There was no space set aside for dancing near the piano, no cushions on the hard chairs or rugs on the floor, and not a shred of elegance in the heavy green brocade drapes.
"We're sorry to bother you, but..."
Mr. Glass broke off mid-sentence to smile at the matron. She'd settled herself on a chair within hearing distance.
"Madam, may we have some privacy, please?"
She wasn't used to having her authority questioned. She didn't put up with it from the lodgers, evicting any girl who broke the rules, but coming from a man, and a gentleman at that, she looked uncertain how to proceed. One of the girls snickered into her teacup.
"Miss Ash is quite safe with us,"
Mr. Glass went on.
"But if you wish to find out more about me, take my card."
She accepted it, turning it over in her hand and rubbing her thumb and finger over it as if she could tell the quality of the man by the quality of his card.
"His father is the Baron of Rycroft,"
Mr. Bailey said. Mr. Glass's smile stiffened, and I got the feeling he was trying not to glare at his friend. Mrs. Whitten finally rose.
Come along, girls. We'll adjourn to the other sitting room.
Mr. Glass waited for them to leave before offering Daisy and I chairs at one of the tables, as if he were hosting us in his own house.
First of all, I want to apologize for coming to your home unannounced.
He cleared his throat and glanced at Daisy, but didn't acknowledge that she'd raced ahead to warn me.
We returned to Bellington House and asked your friend, the painter, where to find you. He gave us Miss Carmichael's address and she directed us here. Don't be angry with her. I was insistent.
Daisy turned to me.
Mr. Bailey gave me no choice. He said they'd arrest me if I refused.
I gasped.
Arrest? Are you policemen?
Mr. Glass reached into his inside jacket pocket and handed me a card.
Not quite, but we work for the police from time to time.
I stared at the card. If he thought us involved with the kidnappers, we could be in awful trouble. A lump of dread formed in my chest. I ought to say something, but I found I couldn't speak.
We consult on cases where magic is involved or suspected,
Mr. Glass went on.
I think the attempted kidnapping is related to the case we're working on,
Mr. Bailey added.
Is that what you think, Mr. Glass?
I asked. Mr. Glass's thumb began to tap on his thigh.
It's the logical explanation. It's the only explanation,
Mr. Bailey told him.
What is the case?
Daisy asked.
We can't discuss it with civilians.
Mr. Glass was a little more civil.
We can't reveal too much, but I can tell you we're investigating the theft of a magical painting.
That explained why Mr. Bailey was working as a waiter at the exhibition.
The artist is a paint magician?
I asked. He nodded. I can see how the theft might be linked to your kidnapping if the thief is trying to stop your investigation.
That's what I tried telling him,
Mr. Bailey said wryly. My courage returned somewhat with every passing moment. Mr. Glass wouldn't be so open with us if he suspected us. But I wanted to make sure.
And you think we had something to do with it?
Daisy spoke before either man had the opportunity.
Why would Sylvia kick one of them if we are in league with them?
To make it look like she's innocent,
Mr. Bailey pointed out. Mr. Glass held up his hand.
We haven't formed an opinion one way or another. We're just trying to clear up a few points.
He lowered his hand to his thigh where his thumb resumed tapping. It appeared to be a nervous habit. I wondered if he'd picked it up in the war. Some men came back with shredded nerves. Some were so bad they could no longer function in society, but others only exhibited mild symptoms like a facial tic or other involuntary physical habit. I tried not to stare.
Can you describe the kidnappers, Miss Ash?
He asked.
A little. You saw them too?
I didn't see the man inside the car. If I'd known he was in there, I would have taken a look, but...
He clicked his tongue, annoyed with himself. It was hardly his fault, however. It had happened so quickly and he'd been caught by surprise. Mr. Bailey agreed.
You were distracted, Gabe.
Clearly, Mr. Bailey still blamed me for that distraction. He was right to do so. I shouldn't have continued to pester Mr. Glass about seeing his mother after his initial refusal. I lowered my head.
I am sorry.
Sorry?
Mr. Glass sounded confused.
I'm afraid I didn't see the other man either.
I gave them a description of the thug I'd seen, but Mr. Glass wrote none of it down. I hadn't told him anything he didn't already know. I wish I could be more help. Daisy?
I have nothing more to add,
she said, still glaring at Mr. Bailey. Mr. Bailey returned it with a narrowed gaze of his own. Mr. Glass sighed.
You've both been a great help. Thank you.
He stood.
If you remember anything, please contact me using the telephone number on my card.
He and Mr. Bailey bade us goodbye, then headed for the door. Mr. Bailey exited, but Mr. Glass turned back.
I wish to apologize for my tone earlier. I'm afraid I was a little brusque with you when you inquired about my mother.
It's all right. I can see you're protective of her.
It's not that. It is,
Mr. Bailey cut in.
Very well, it is in part.
My mother doesn't like the attention that comes with being known as the Mother of Magic, or whatever it is the newspapers have dubbed her this year. She prefers a quiet life and has little to do with magicians or policymaking these days. The grandiose things you've heard about her are probably not true.
I haven't heard anything about her. That's the point. My brother wrote her name in his notebook, suggesting she might be able to give answers about whether we're silver magicians or not. I have no idea how she could answer that. It's me who should apologize to you. You were right to direct me to the Silversmiths Guild. If there is silver magic in our family, they will be listed in the guild's archives.
Only if they were from London.
He arched his brows. I shrugged. I had no idea where the ashes were from originally. The guild is closed over the weekend. I'll return during my lunch hour on Monday and ask their archivist if he can find out anything about the Ash name.
Don't forget your mother's maiden name and your grandmother's. Go back as far as you can,
Mr. Bailey added. She knows that, Daisy snapped. That was the problem. I knew nothing about my grandmother's. I'd never met my grandparents, and my mother never mentioned them. Or rather, she refused to tell James and me anything about them. We were scolded whenever we asked.
What I can tell you is that silver magic is rare, Mr. Glass said. If the guild knows of a silver magician, they're probably related to you.
I highly doubt there's magic in my family. I feel nothing when I touch silver things. I fingered my mother's ring, which I'd kept on my finger. I should feel something, shouldn't I?
If you're a magician, yes. It's possible you didn't inherit the magic and your brother did. If one parent is artless and the other a magician, there's a 50% chance the children will be artless. Which parent or grandparent did your brother suspect of being a silver magician?
I looked down at the ring. I don't know. My mother never mentioned magic, and I never met my father. I looked away, unable to meet his gaze. What must he think of me? A fatherless child of indeterminate lineage? The shame I'd felt growing up came back to haunt me. Children can be cruel. When they learned that James and I didn't know anything about our father, they teased us mercilessly. It was another reason I had so few friends.
Where do you work? Mr. Glass suddenly asked.
In the London Philosophical Society's library. Why?
In case I need to speak to you again. I'd rather not face Mrs. Whitten's wrath a second time.
He touched the brim of his cap and headed out with Mr. Bailey on his heels. I stared down at his card, cradled in the palm of my hand. It gave no address and only included a telephone number. I tucked it into my skirt pocket and tried to think of a detail about the kidnappers I may have forgotten to tell him. But no matter how hard I tried, I could think of no reason to telephone him. I don't like that man, Daisy said.
Which one?
The big one. How dare he suspect us of aiding the kidnappers when your interference is the only thing that saved Mr. Glass? He's just worried about his friend. Besides, he has a right to be suspicious. After all, we only took employment at the exhibition so we could speak to his friend, and were there when the attempted kidnapping took place. I still don't like him. He flirted with me before the kidnapping attempt. Clearly he thought us suspicious from the moment he met us, and without evidence too. That's a violation of my rights. I smiled. Not quite. But I do see your point. How dare a man flirt with you without evidence of your guilt? It was meant as a joke to point out that he was probably flirting with her because he wanted to get to know her better, but she was oblivious. Precisely. I'm glad you see it my way, Sylv. On Monday morning, I found myself sneaking glances at the newspaper article about Mr. Glass, instead of working. The day before, I'd wanted to discuss his visit with Daisy again, but she was busy painting. When the muse caught her, it held on fast and didn't let go. Her responses to my questions were mere grunts or simply made no sense. When I asked whether she thought Mr. Glass was a magician, she said, "Hmm." Given no further response, I decided that was an agreement.
After all, his mother was supposed to be very powerful, and she'd probably wanted her children to be magicians too, so had married one to make sure. I leaned a hip against the desk and scoured the article once more for mention of him being a magician.
Reading about me again, Miss Ash?
Mr. Glass!
I dropped the newspaper on the desk, but it was too late. He'd seen me. He must think me an obsessive admirer. Ugh! Yet another humiliation to add to the list.
I was just, reading the advertisement beside it.
He picked up the newspaper and read.
Lamar reducing soap. No dieting or exercise. Acts like magic in reducing double chin.
He glanced at my chin. His mouth didn't move, but those green eyes danced with humor.
Abdomen, ungainly ankles, unbecoming wrists, arms and shoulders, large...
He cleared his throat and returned the newspaper to the desk.
If you really were reading the ad, may I point out that you don't need this soap?
My face flamed. There was nothing for it but to brazen it out. I snatched up the newspaper and threw it in the rubbish bin.
No, you may not.
He laughed softly.
You may have been reading the article, not the ad, but you'd have no reason to deny that, would you? I mean, there's nothing wrong with reading it a second time. Or is it the third?
It was more than that, but I wasn't going to admit it. The man was more self-absorbed than I'd realized. Daisy's first impression of him was perhaps the most accurate after all. The abundance of good fortune had turned him into an egotist.
Are you a member of the society, Mr. Glass?
I asked.
No. Should I join?
He glanced around, taking in the desk with the pile of old books, the shelving stacks that rose on either side of us, and the comfortable leather armchair.
I'm not much of a philosopher, but perhaps I can reflect on life while you work. It's very quiet.
He made it sound like a curiosity, or even a criticism. It's a library. It's supposed to be quiet. And there's nothing wrong with being left in peace with only one's thoughts for company.
Depends on the thoughts, he said darkly.
Before I could respond, he added,
I wanted to apologize for the way Alex and I spoke to you and Miss Carmichael on Saturday. We made you feel like suspects, and that wasn't fair.
It wasn't confirmation that he'd removed us from his list of suspects. We were still on it. We were probably at the top. I arched my brows, waiting for him to say more, perhaps even confirm or deny it. He studied the cover of one of the books on the desk, fingering the frayed cloth edge somewhat absently. Why the hesitation?
I came to tell you something that occurred to me just this morning.
Go on.
I think you may be from a family of silver magicians, after all.
Why do you think that?
I asked on a rush of breath.
Your name is Sylvia.
My hopes had lifted, but now sank again. I nodded, but did not tell him I'd already considered the connection. Indeed, it was so obvious that it was hardly worth mentioning at all. He couldn't possibly have come here just to tell me that. I waited for more, but none came.
Is something the matter, Miss Ash?
No, I said heavily. You should go.
Should I not have come to your place of work? There was no one downstairs, so I decided to try my luck up here. Should I have signed in?
You didn't see Mr. Parmiter.
He shook his head and shrugged, as if it didn't matter. But it mattered to Mr. Parmiter.
Thank you for coming all this way to tell me my name, Mr. Glass.
I winced. I hadn't meant to be sarcastic. Not out loud, anyway.
I appreciate it. But please don't trouble yourself with my little problem anymore. You must be terribly busy and...
I cut myself off and silently groaned as Mr. Parmiter emerged from behind the nearest stack. I hated that it hid anyone coming up the stairs from view. If I was preoccupied, like now, I didn't hear footsteps.
Sir?
Mr. Parmiter barked.
Are you a member here?
Mr. Glass extended his hand.
Gabriel Glass, at your service. I was just here to...
Are you a member?
Mr. Glass lowered his hand.
No, I'm here to speak to Miss Ash about...
Then kindly leave.
Mr. Parmiter indicated the way to the staircase.
The library is for the use of members only.
Mr. Gloss's jaw firmed.
You misunderstand. I work for Scotland Yard.
He produced a card and handed it to Mr. Parmiter. Mr. Parmiter held it at arm's length and peered down his nose as he read.
Is Miss Ash in trouble?
She witnessed a crime, and I came to ask her some follow-up questions.
You should have spoken to me first and asked permission. Non-members are not allowed.
Surely you can make an exception for the police.
Your card says you are a consultant for Scotland Yard, not an actual policeman.
I wanted to crawl into the cavity under the desk and hide there. Mr. Parmiter had always been nice to the society's members, so I thought he just disliked women in general, or Daisy and me in particular. But his rudeness to Mr. Glass proved he loathed anyone associated with me, no matter how loose that association. Mr. Glass held up his hands in surrender.
I hope I haven't caused Miss Ash any trouble. It was unwittingly done. If someone had been on the desk downstairs, I would have checked first before going in search of her.
Since Mr. Parmiter was supposed to be on the desk, he took the comment as a slight on his work ethic. His lips quivered with indignation.
If you've quite finished,
he bit off. Mr. Glass touched the brim of his cap.
Good day, Miss Ash, and thank you again for your assistance with my investigation.
He apologized to Mr. Parmiter for keeping me from my work, then left. Mr. Parmiter swung around to face me.
You can see out the rest of the day, but don't bother to come in tomorrow.
My jaw dropped. I stared at him.
You're dismissing me because of a visit that I had no control over. That's not fair.
It's not just him. There's that silly girl who regularly sneaks in, as well as the makeup.
I don't wear makeup.
He sniffed.
Your paramour was the last straw. A Scotland Yard consultant, indeed.
He is.
I snatched the card from him and waved it in front of his face.
Anyone can get fake cards made up. That man does not work for the police. He's too young to be a consultant. Either you've been duped or you're trying to fool me.
It took me a moment to gather my wits and find the words to express myself. But when I did find them, I grabbed my bag and rounded the desk. I might be shorter than Mr. Parmiter, but I like to think he reeled back because of the fierce look on my face, not the fact that I stepped so close to him that we were almost toe-to-toe.
You should be ashamed of yourself for the way you treat people, but I doubt you have the depth of character to feel shame for your behavior.
He thrust out his chin, making it a good target if I were inclined to punch him.
You won't be getting a reference from me, Miss Ash.
I don't care.
I tucked my bag under my arm and walked off. I couldn't bear to look at him any longer.
Where are you going? You have to finish the day.
Deduct it from my wages.
I resisted the urge to give him a rude gesture as Daisy would do, but I did utter a string of expletives under my breath as I stormed out of the building. The member waiting at the front desk with a book made sounds of disgust through his overgrown moustache. I exited the society building, crossed the road, and did not look back. Chapter 4. Storming out may have felt cathartic, and it got my point across perfectly, but now I had no reference from my most recent employer. I spent the rest of the week answering job advertisements, speaking to agencies, and attending interviews. I applied for any work that looked remotely suitable. There was only one advertised position for a junior journalist, and I didn't even get an interview for it. When I inquired at the newspaper office, I was told dozens of men had progressed to the interview stage. Now that the war was over and returned soldiers flooded the employment market, it would be almost impossible to find a job traditionally done by men. So I gave up and applied for jobs usually done by women. The result was the same. They didn't want me either. It's so disheartening, I said to Daisy and Horatio when I entered Daisy's flat on Friday evening. Horatio took my coat and hung it on the stand near the door. He planted a kiss on my cheek.
You sound like you need a drink. Daisy's mixing cocktails.
Martinis,
Daisy said from the sideboard. I sat on the sofa.
Sounds exotic. Horatio sat beside me. What work have you applied for?
Everything. Telephone operator, shop girl, secretary.
Charwoman? Daisy asked.
Not yet, but I may have to.
Horatio pulled a face.
You're too pretty and clever for manual work.
I'll work in a factory if I have to. I need the money.
That explains the old coat you've been wearing. Let me guess, it's your only one?
I put a hand to my lips in mock horror.
You mean people have more than one coat in their wardrobe?
Shocking, I know.
He nudged me with his shoulder.
How desperate are you?
If I don't find work next week, I won't be able to pay for my room at the lodging house.
Daisy handed me a cocktail in a coupe glass and another to Horatio.
Is that such a bad thing? That place is a prison for single women, and that Mrs. Whitless is the warden.
Mrs. Whitten is not that bad. She has a great responsibility, keeping all of us safe.
Daisy grunted as she sat on the brown leather armchair, tucking her legs under her. The chair did not match any of the other furniture. Indeed, none of the furniture matched. The sofa on which Horatio and I sat was an ancient Georgian thing covered in tattered silk that had probably once been lustrous gold, but had faded to the color of bone. Daisy tried to hide the stains with throws and cushions that smelled faintly of turpentine. Or perhaps the smell came from Horatio. A thick-leg dining table was being used as a desk for her sketches, as was another smaller table beside the sofa. All the furniture had been pushed to one side of the open space to make way for her easels and canvases, as well as the sideboard. The entire flat was devoid of knick-knacks, except for a small bronze sculpture of a basset hound taking pride of place on a side table. The lack of clutter allowed more room for paintings, sketches, and her bicycle, the latter hidden by the door when it was open. The eclectic ensemble of decor and furniture worked, rather like Daisy herself. Her studio flat was much larger than the space allocated to me in the lodging house, and I admit to being envious. The old building had been renovated and turned into flats, and the attic removed altogether to increase the height of the ceilings in the top floor rooms. The newly created flats benefited from vaulted ceilings and plenty of light, perfect for an artist. Daisy accessed the bedroom on the mezzanine level via a rickety ladder that looked as though it would be difficult to navigate after a few cocktails. The lower level of the flat was one large open area that combined art studio, sitting room, dining room, and kitchenette into one. A door led to a bathroom. There was no queuing for the bath for her, no cold showers if she left it too late, and no being shouted at through the door to hurry up. She had it all to herself. The rent must be quickly eating through her grandparents' inheritance, however. If she didn't sell some paintings soon, she might find herself joining me in the lodging house. You should see the signs posted up all over the lodging house walls, Horatio, Daisy said. Keep innocence, protect your virtue.
Do the signs work? He asked.
No, both Daisy and I said at the same time. He smiled into his cocktail glass.
Thank you for the hint.
I laughed softly. From what I'd learned of Horatio, he was an incorrigible flirt with the love of life, women, and probably men too. Since losing my position at the library, I'd spent every afternoon with Daisy and sometimes Horatio, lamenting my dreadful luck in finding new employment. They were good listeners, supportive, but not practically helpful. I started to wonder if either of them had needed to look for work in their lives. Horatio was a successful artist and managed to earn enough from his paintings to make a living, while Daisy survived on her inheritance. She tilted her head to the side.
You don't need another lover, Horatio. You have Lucy.
Lacey? Horatio shrugged. She's all right, but she's just not inspiring me anymore.
You're bored of her already. Honestly, you're as fickle as a butterfly in a spring garden.
And just as lovely, too.
I laughed, and Daisy rolled her eyes. Horatio snapped his fingers.
Sylvia, you can do it.
I'd been about to sip my cocktail, but his sudden outburst made me spill a little down my blouse.
I may be desperate, but I won't be your lover.
not my lover, my muse. Daisy leaned over and offered me a handkerchief.
Isn't it the same thing with you?
Sometimes. Daisy and I arched our brows at him. Very well, all the time. But you can be different, Sylvia. All you have to do is sit for me and look ethereal. I promise not to touch you. Unless you want me to, of course.
Would I be fully clothed?
He chuckled, but it quickly faded. Oh, you were serious. The position of my muse requires you to be naked, but I promise I won't see your body as a man does. I'll view you through an artist's lens.
Thank you for the offer, but I think I'll continue looking for other work.
I sipped my cocktail.
This is fresh. What is it?
A martini, Daisy said.
Gin, vermouth, and orange bitters. It's popular in America.
Well, it was before Prohibition.
Poor sods. Horatio downed his cocktail in one gulp and held his glass out for Daisy to refill.
I need another. I don't take rejection well.
Daisy uncurled herself from the armchair and took the glass. Horatio turned to me, a hand to his heart.
Despite the blow you've dealt me, I'm going to help you. I know where you might find temporary work.
I sat up straighter.
Where?
The Royal Academy.
My heart sank. This would be for the same exhibition where I made a fool of myself, the butler dismissed me, and the patroness admonished me for daring to speak to a guest?
Lady Stanhope isn't a patron. Her husband is an honorary member. She's just a rude cow who likes to feel important. Anyway, she won't be there, and nor will the butler. The private viewing is over, and now that it's the public's turn, Lady Stanhope makes herself scarce. She prefers not to associate with the common rabble. Ludlow is also superfluous. He's semi-retired and only works during the private viewing at Lady Stanhope's request. Most of the extra staff who were employed for last week have already left. Those who are still there will probably want to pat you on the back. Your exit is legendary.
Daisy perked up.
It was rather fun, wasn't it, Sylvia?
Not really, I said with a shake of my head and a smile. It was better to laugh off humiliation than stew in it. Besides, I'd had enough of stewing. I wanted to forge ahead and forget. What did it matter what Mr. Glass thought of me? I'd never see him again.
The job won't be in the kitchen or serving this time,
Horatio went on.
Starting on Monday evening, they're rotating some of the paintings. Some will be removed altogether and returned to the owners or the artists, while others will be moved to different rooms based on feedback from the private viewing. The work all happens after hours.
I heard the exhibition manager's assistant is unwell. I'm sure you could fill in until he gets back, Sylvia. Why not try your luck on Monday afternoon when the manager is there? It was the best offer I'd had all week. It was the only offer.
I will. Thank you, Horatio. You're a gem.
Daisy handed Horatio a glass, and he saluted me with it.
And if you change your mind, I'm still willing to take you on as my model.
Thank you.
He looked pleased, despite my sarcastic tone. You bounce back from rejection quickly, I said.
There is just too much to be happy about to be down for long.
Daisy leaned forward and clinked her glass with his.
Here's to new opportunities, new friends, and a new decade. I have a feeling it will be 1,000 times better than the last one.
Horatio sighed theatrically.
Dear God, I hope so.
As did I.
Speaking of new friends, have you seen that handsome Glass fellow since Monday?
He asked. I shook my head.
I don't expect to see him again.
Are you quite sure about that?
He winked at Daisy. She blinked back.
Why would Sylvia see him? She lost her job because of him.
I pressed my lips together to stop myself telling her his visit was merely the icing on the cake for Mr. Parmiter. The flour, eggs, and butter were mostly her. Horatio turned to me and pulled a face that Daisy couldn't see.
Let me know if you do see him again.
I'll give you some hints on how to flirt with men like him.
She won't be flirting with him. Stop encouraging her, Horatio.
Flirting can be a great way to obtain information.
Daisy sank in the chair.
I know,
she muttered.
His friend knows it too. Blast him.
All I'm suggesting is that if Sylvia wants to find out if he still suspects you two of being involved in the kidnapping, she ought to be friendly.
He pushed himself up from the sofa and put out his hand to Daisy. Now, show me your latest masterpiece, darling. She drew in a breath.
Really? You want to see it? Marvelous.
She sprang off the chair and, grinning, asked us both to follow her. I could throttle Horatio, but he seemed genuinely enthusiastic about looking at her pieces. It only proved even further that I knew nothing about art. Daisy's paintings were not to my taste at all. Even so, I managed to nod and smile at the appropriate times, and I was rewarded with her genuine happiness in return. Perhaps Horatio was only humoring her, but I was glad he did if this was the result. Next time I saw Horatio, I would kiss him. When I arrived at Burlington House late on Monday afternoon, I found the exhibition manager's office in turmoil. His assistant was still sick and the work was piling up. It was easy to convince Mr. Bolton that I was capable of performing the necessary duties. I informed him that I'd been a journalist for a number of years and then a librarian here in London most recently.
Your references?
He said without looking up from his paperwork. I placed the ones I had in front of him. He quickly scanned them. Indeed, he did it so fast that he mustn't have noticed the one from the library was missing altogether and that none of them were recent. He pulled a wooden box out of his top desk drawer and selected a rubber stamp from among several neatly arranged inside, as well as an ink pad. He stamped my references with the word accepted, then stood and buttoned up his jacket.
You'll do.
He indicated I should walk out of the office ahead of him.
Hang up your coat and take this clipboard.
Mr. Bolton was like a military commander with his barked orders and brisk assessment. After he asked me to wait in the corridor and nipped back into his office to retrieve a short stick, the resemblance to a general was even more pronounced. He thrust it under his arm and marched on. We spent the next 2 hours going from one gallery to the next, checking off the artwork against his list. He used the stick as a pointer, both at the art on the wall and at me when he wanted me to note something down. At the end of 2 hours, the six-man packing team arrived. Mr. Bolton clicked his fingers at me.
The list, Miss Ash.
I handed him the clipboard, but he handed it straight back.
Remove the main copy and keep it. You'll be needing it shortly.
I unclipped the top copy and returned the clipboard to him. He passed it to one of the packers.
The paintings on the front page require removal. There are 13.
Unlucky number,
one of the packers muttered. Mr. Bolton pointed his stick at the fellow.
You're new. What's your name?
The packer rested an arm on the upright trolley's handles.
Tommy Allen, sir.
There's no place for silly superstitions in this institution, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Allen ran his tongue around his top teeth and made a sucking sound. The heavy-lidded stare he gave Mr. Bolton was made more sinister thanks to the scar stretching from the corner of his mouth to his ear. Both of his ears were covered by his hair. I wouldn't be surprised if the ear near the scar had been damaged or was missing altogether. Scars like his were not unusual on former servicemen. The head packer split his men into two groups, one of four and the other with two. Mr. Bolton assigned me to oversee the moving crew.
Make sure they put the right pieces in the right places according to your list. I will oversee the packing team.
The group of four turned out to be the moving team. One of them was Mr. Allen. He was the first to move off, only to be called back by Mr. Bolton. The exhibition manager ran through a list of do's and don'ts for both teams, most of it boiling down to not touching the paint. Going by the bored expressions of all the men, I suspected the lecture was unnecessary. Most had done this before. When he finally finished, Mr. Bolton clicked the heels of his shoes together and pointed to the adjoining gallery with his stick.
Onward, packing team.
Two of the men followed him. Since my team was starting in the main gallery, we stayed put. Mr. Allen spat on the tiled floor.
Thought I was done with toffs like him giving me instructions for a job I can do better than them.
one of the other packers, glanced at me.
Better clean that up, Tommy.
Tommy Allen sneered at me before walking off.
Cleaning's a woman's job.
I bit down on my retort and walked off too, leaving the gob of spit untouched. Mr. Allen was not the sort of man I wanted to have a confrontation with, particularly on my first day. I would give him the opportunity to clean it up in his own time. It was going to be a long evening. We worked for 4 hours, by which time my crew were growing restless. It was late and we'd not stopped. Well, most of us hadn't. Mr. Allen had taken a 10-minute break to smoke a cigarette. I watched with growing irritation as the ash dropped onto the floor as he made his way around the room, perusing the paintings. When he finished, he dropped the butt near his foot and ground it with his heel. When he stopped work again after 4 hours, I decided it was time for them all to have a break. I went in search of Mr. Bolton and found him with the packing crew in one of the smaller galleries. His two-man team held a painting between them as they carried it to a crate. Mr. Bolton stood to one side, reading a scrap of paper. I approached.
Do you mind if we stop for a short while? The men are thirsty and tired.
He tucked the paper into his jacket pocket and checked the watch hanging from the gold chain at his waistcoat.
Very well. It is late. You too.
He pointed his stick at his men.
Finish up with that one for tonight. We'll resume again tomorrow evening.
I caught up to the two packers, but had to wait as they maneuvered the large painting through the door. It gave me an opportunity to admire it. It depicted a country village street scene with horse-drawn carts, carriages, and two pedestrians. It was pretty, but otherwise unremarkable. Even so, I couldn't stop staring at it. It intrigued me. The men turned it around to place it into the upright crate. Something in the corner at the back caught my eye. The canvas was torn. No, not torn. It had simply come away and folded over. But how could that be? The canvas had looked undamaged from the front. It was stretched taut, just as a painter's canvas ought to be. There were no gaps, tears, or folds. Was there a second canvas behind the village scene painting? I edged closer and reached out a hand to touch it.
Miss Ash,
Mr. Bolton barked.
What are you doing?
I snatched my hand back to my chest and looked up upon hearing a snicker. Mr. Allen leaned against the doorframe between the two galleries, smoking. Mr. Bolton marched up to me.
Go and see to your men, Miss Ash. You, Mr. Allen. Don't just stand there.
Mr. Allen blew out a puff of smoke from the corner of his mouth, then dropped the cigarette butt on the floor. His lips twisted into a sly smile directed at me. I steeled myself.
Please pick that up, Mr. Allen, and the other one too.
Didn't you hear me before? Cleaning's woman's work.
The cleaners aren't here.
He merely shrugged and turned away.
Then do it yourself. But...
He rounded on me, his eyes flashing.
But what? It ain't your job to clean up. That's only because you took a man's job.
He stabbed a finger at the floor.
You should be on your knees, scrubbing, and a man who fought for his country should be walking around here with a list and pencil. Instead, good men have to beg on street corners, their faces covered so as not to frighten the harpies who took their work.
He'd lowered his voice so that only I could hear. It loaned a menacing edge to his words.
Is something the matter?
Mr. Bolton called out. Mr. Allen sucked air through his teeth, shot a glare at the exhibition manager, and walked off. Mr. Bolton swallowed hard.
Please pick up the cigarette butts before you go, Miss Ash.
He marched into the next gallery, stick wedged under his arm. The two men from the packing team asked me to step aside. They carried the narrow crate between them, the painting of the village safely stored inside. They settled it on the trolley, and one man wheeled it off.
Where is that going?
I asked the other.
To the storeroom, until the artist comes to collect it. It wasn't sold, so it will be returned to him. Apparently it ain't good enough to stay up, not when there are others that need a turn. Not like that beauty.
He nodded at the wall at the end of the large gallery, where the painting of the steamship powering through the ocean now hung. My crew had moved the seascape to pride of place as instructed by Mr. Bolton. Based on feedback from the private viewing, it was deemed worthy to be one of the first paintings to be seen as people entered the main gallery.
I agreed with the packer. It was a beauty and deserved prime spot. I didn't mention the extra canvas behind the village painting to Mr. Bolton. He might be one of Mr. Glass's suspects, and I didn't want to ruin the investigation. Indeed, Mr. Glass might even be aware of the hidden canvas. Leaving it in place might be part of his plan to catch the thieves. Even so, I decided to telephone him first thing in the morning. He wasn't at home, however. With only one telephone in the lodging house, I couldn't be sure I'd be notified if he returned my call, so I asked when he would be back. There was a muffled sound on the other end. Then a different voice came on the line.
"Who are you and what do you want?"
the woman barked in a thick American accent.
It's a simple question.
I held the receiver away from my ear so as not to be deafened next time she spoke. "My name is Sylvia Ash, and I have some information for Mr. Glass about the investigation he's working on."
"Gabe mentioned you. You can come over. The address is 16 Park Street, Mayfair. Come now."
"Will he be home by—" The line went dead. I stared at the receiver, and eventually hung it up. It would seem I was going to see where Mr. Glass lived. In Mayfair, no less. It was a pleasant morning, so I dispensed with my coat and wore my best outfit of black pleated skirt and matching jacket with a white blouse. A black cloche hat adorned with ribbon, the only new purchase I'd made since arriving in London, completed the outfit. All that black meant that by the time I walked to Mayfair, I was hot. It might be time to invest in some new, more modern clothes in more cheerful colours, but I needed to find work to pay for them first. Park Street was one of those London streets that only the wealthy could afford to live on. Number 16 was located in a row of handsome red and cream brick townhouses with a set of steps parallel to the pavement leading down to the service area basement. I bypassed those steps and headed up the ones that led to the front door. My knock was answered by an ancient butler who led me through to the drawing room. He instructed me to wait and disappeared before I could ask if Mr. Glass had returned. I took a turn around the large room. It was everything I expected of a Mayfair drawing room, complete with a lovely clock encased in a glass dome on the mantelpiece, gilt-framed paintings, and expensive-looking furniture. The decor was somewhat dated, but it suited the grand old townhouse, and it wasn't cluttered like many houses decorated by women of Lady Rycroft's age. The only other drawing room of a large townhouse I'd seen had been packed with occasional tables, their surfaces covered with knick-knacks, photographs, and a stuffed bird or two. This drawing room was perfect, not a cushion out of place. I didn't dare sit down. If it wasn't for the cluster of framed family photographs on one of the tables, the room would have suffered from being too formal. But the photos made it homely. I bent to study them and smiled at a picture of Gabe, aged about 10. He stood between two adults who must be his parents. I could see where he got his good looks from. I straightened, as a man sauntered into the room. He stopped and studied me, so I studied him back, albeit with a tentative smile. He was an odd-looking fellow, his age difficult to determine. He could be in his early 30s or all the way up to 50 or so. He was short and wiry, with sharp cheekbones and light brown hair that was arranged rather messily.
"Well, it's about time."
The voice belonged to the person I'd spoken to on the telephone, and a woman at that, not a man. It was an easy mistake to make, dressed as she was in trousers, white shirt and waistcoat. The sleeves on the shirt were rolled to her elbows and she wore no tie. When she came closer, I could see that her long brown hair was streaked with slivers of grey. She wore it tied up at the back of her head.
"About time?"
I echoed.
"I thought you'd get here ages ago. You live in Bloomsbury, don't you? It doesn't take 30 minutes to get here from Bloomsbury."
"It does if you walk."
"Walk? Why do you want to do that?"
"It's a nice day, and you said Mr. Glass wasn't back when we spoke earlier on the telephone. I thought I'd give him time to get here." She grunted.
"Sit down. You can tell me what you want to tell him. I'll pass it on."
I sat on the sofa. She sat on the chair opposite, with her legs apart and her elbows out. Although her habits and manner were masculine,
She was small and fine-boned. The odd combination was intriguing.
Quit staring. A woman dressed in trousers ain't a strange sight these days. The war saw to that.
I looked down at my hands in my lap. Sorry.
Go on, then.
Pardon?
Tell me what you wanted to tell Gabe.
I glanced at the door, but no one was there. We were quite alone. I wished the butler hadn't left. This woman unnerved me. I have some information about the case he's working on.
So you said over the telephone?
She signaled for me to continue with the flick of her wrist.
You can tell it to me and I'll tell Gabe.
I'd rather tell him in person. Is he expected home soon? She crossed one leg over the other and jiggled her foot up and down.
You can trust me, Miss Ash. I live here.
Was she a servant, playing at being hostess while the master was out? Aside from family, who else would live in Lord and Lady Rycroft's townhouse? Whoever she was, I wasn't going to tell her anything without Mr. Glass's approval. She didn't look like she was going to back down either. We sat in a silence that grew weightier by the moment, she glaring daggers at me from across the room as I tried